This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. And we're very pleased to be talking to two Israeli conscientious objectors, sometimes called refuseniks. And they are Einat Gerlitz and Tal Mitnick. And welcome to the program.
Hi, Phil.
Hi,
pretty good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
There's a lot to talk about. Your country, Israel, is in ferment. Actually, the whole world seems to be in ferment, but you particularly. And something dramatic has happened. Here we read about Gaza and the terrible loss of life and the question of whether or not there's going to be wider war and such things. And at this very moment, both of you have done something quite remarkable. That is, you've refused to serve in the Israeli military. I want to ask you, Tal, first of all, my understanding is that your refusal came in October 23. Is that right?
I refused in December of 2023, yes.
December.
I was the first public refuser after October 7th.
At this moment after October 7th. And I read that you said that this is a moment that when you wanted the public to know why, you said you didn't believe in revenge and that you were not going to serve in an army that was carrying out revenge against the population. Is that roughly right? How did you handle that? And what kind of response did you get?
It's true. That was what I said. I would not serve in an army that is enacting a revenge war, a genocide on the Palestinian people. The response in Israeli society was very, very heated. It's a society that's in constant trauma, and especially after the horrible attack of October 7th. I got death threats. My family got death threats. My address got leaked. It was a tough response, but I'm very blessed to have supportive family, supportive friends. And also, I got a lot of very, very warm messages from the international community, and it strengthened me in continuing my fight and continuing to refuse.
Yeah. And you were sentenced, you did 6 months. It sounded peculiar, as I understood it, that they kept sort of testing you. Do you want to change your mind? And could you explain what that was about? You spent 6 months, but what's this issue they have with the word conscientious objector?
Well, before going to prison, I appealed to a conscientious committee that was supposed to test me on if I was a conscientious objector. Mm-hmm. They brought quotes from past interviews that I did opposing the occupation, opposing the war, and they decided that I was not a conscientious objector. I was a specific objector to this specific army. Which totally goes apart from what the international standards for a conscientious committee is. After getting rejected by the conscientious committee, I was sentenced to 30 days in military prison. And after getting out from 30 days, I found myself with a new draft order for the next day to come and enlist. So I refused again and again for five times, and I sat five times in prison, amounting to 185 days.
At the end of into that process, they decided to not, they didn't make a determination. They simply stopped calling you in?
They gave me an exemption on mental health grounds at the end. Yeah.
I'm learning to say the word. Einat, I'm sorry. Gerlitz, you'd already made up your mind you were not going to serve.
Yes.
And you have an interesting story there. When they called you, if I understand rightly, you said this is my opportunity to make this into something rather than simply go along or be quiet. So can you talk about that?
Definitely. I feel like refusal isn't necessarily a privilege, but being public about it definitely is. And when I refused, it was before October 7th, I refused in September of 2022. And then me and three other refusers had similar enlistment dates, and we did a big public campaign together. And we did a public campaign because We believe that it's not only important to refuse and not take part in the occupation and the apartheid, but also use the privilege that we have of relatively supportive families to speak out and to speak up about it and to share our voices and our perspective and our criticism so we can speak to the Israeli public, to speak to the international world, to speak also for those refusers who don't have the privilege to be public about their refusal. So I think that's what led me wanting to create change and to show solidarity publicly with the Palestinian struggle.
And you, psychologically, both of you really being tested. By the way, I believe, Tal, you're 19, 20 years old.
19, yes.
I'm 21.
And you're 21. It is said of Israeli youth that unlike the world youth reaction to the issue of Palestine, that actually you're up against tough odds within Israeli society, and that youth are largely apparently in support, right? And so that is kind of a remarkable challenge. But psychologically, as I understand it, you were quite prepared because you began to have doubts or questions when you were 16 years old.
Yes, I decided that I'm going to refuse around 17. In high school, I became involved in queer movements and in a climate movement. And there I met for the first time Palestinians. Having Palestinian friends for the first time, they were Israeli citizens, really changed my perspective. And I understood that I do not want to enlist the force that oppresses and occupies their families. And that's when I decided that I'm going to refuse. And then meeting Misalvot Network, which is a network that we come from, I had the opportunity to have the support to do it publicly.
There's something I read about that struck me. I didn't realize this, that you begin preparation to be part of the Israeli military when you're at the age of 16. They begin kind of test, and they talk about meaningful service. Is that the term?
Yes, exactly. Meaningful service is a term that's...
They gave you an opening because they're talking about meaningful, so you must have, you had to go through that process. Did both you both had that experience at 16?
Yes.
What is that all about, this business? I'll ask Anat.
So from the age of 16, from 11th grade, you begin to receive orders to come to the enlistment base, and they test you for different kinds of roles in the military to see what you're most suitable for. And in our society, we grow up knowing that we are going to go to the military once we finish high school. Obviously, that's the duty, and that's seen as an important thing to do to give back to your society. That's what we're told. And doing a meaningful service, it's this term that many youth want to have a meaningful service.
It sounds like ideological training.
Yeah.
Why aren't the political parties of Israel, some of them at least, opposed to that? It sounds like almost like a kind of brainwashing, right? To make a 16-year-old begin to have to sort out their relationship to the army. Go ahead.
Well, the reason why there's not a lot of there's a reason why there's support for enlistment, for militarism, for all these horrible things is the same reason why. The American public was so much in support of the invasion of Iraq or Afghanistan, and I can hear myself voice. And the reason why the German public was so much in support of the war in World War II, Israeli society is not special in that way. It is the fascism, militarism, and strong nationalism that is seeped into every mind that is perpetuating the system of militarism and in that oppressing the Palestinians on a daily basis.
Yeah. It's certainly a cruel business, and it was hard. They gave you a hard time, if I read it right, that they really kind of psychologically tried to beat up on you, right, on the question of why you weren't cooperating.
Yes.
What was that like?
So I appealed to a conscientious committee prior to my enlistment day. They check if you're qualified as a conscientious objector according to the Israeli military standards, which are a violation of the international standards, like Tal said before. And they ask you these tough questions of what do you fight if you were in Britain in World War II? Would you fight against the Nazis? And all these kinds of questions that I don't know who I would have been in what in that situation, and these hypocritical questions, and expecting you to show this very absolute kind of pacifism that is many times disconnected from reality. And it's a very tough experience sitting in front of many military generals and being questioned.
After
those 87 days,
some people
able to
broke
see
down,
another,
right?
Yeah, it's a very tough experience, and many people, I came out crying out of those committees. It's not a nice experience, but I think that's my small, that's a small price I pay for the biggest struggle, and you can't even compare it to the price the Palestinians pay.
Yeah. Now, there's a wide movement in Israel. There are voices coming from various directions, unhappy with the way Netanyahu is running things. Some of them, I understand, reservists, for example, are refusing to go back, and there's been difficulty on that front. And how do those other voices relate to those of you who are refuseniks? What's that like?
The war has had a very strong impact on Israeli society. That's not to even talk about. I mean, I know that all the listeners know how much the genocide has impacted the Palestinian society in Gaza and the West Bank in 48. And talking about my own society, people have come back traumatized. People have spent the whole year and a half fighting in this war that doesn't bring any security to anyone. And then they come back and the violence comes back into the household first. It gets first to the women that are in the household of the reservists that fight. So in that way, the Israeli society is on this perpetual circle of trauma after trauma after trauma. Yeah. And this just feeds into the cycle of violence. And yes.
Yeah. Well, that's, of course, I would say the best in terms of people around the world, what they like to hear is voices like yours that say, actually, this cannot be solved by violence. It would seem obvious to ordinary person who hasn't been initiated into military think, I guess, is that why isn't there somebody offering a peaceful solution? Are you asked that a lot about, well, what do you propose in the way of solving this, Inat?
Yes, we are asked that. I think that I feel like these, I don't know, talking about these political solutions, like looking, seems very far away. I think the immediate thing that we're looking for is putting a complete stop to the genocide, releasing all the hostages, the next step, you know, having an end to the occupation, and I think fighting for the basic human rights and the most, we're in an emergency situation right now.
Yeah.
And talking about these far-fetched solutions seems very, very, like, seems like so many steps ahead of us. And I think that what we need to do right now is tackle the immediate situation and make sure that the ceasefire is permanent, and opening up the gates for humanitarian aid inside of Gaza.
Yeah. As far as I know, when you address these things, you're actually speaking to something which, again, is fundamental, that is equal treatment for the Palestinians. There's always a historical business. We hear about the borders, what borders, I think I saw in a press release somewhere, you speak of the 1948 border, or people associated with you. Is that the case? I mean, do people in Canada, for example, when they talk to you, do they ask, well, you want a two-state, or that kind of thing? Does that come up?
Yes, I think it comes up a lot, and it's, I think, a very important subject debated. Here we understand in Canada a lot, but on the ground right now, inside Israeli society, there's not even an opening to talk about Palestinian independence, not talk about two states, not talk about one state.
Mm-hmm.
And the coalition that we're building is around people who are allies to Palestinian liberation. and we believe that we want to form as large as a circle as we have as we can to build power and advocate for this liberation. And when we stop settlers invading villages like there was just yesterday in Masafer Yatta, when we stop the expulsion of tens of thousands of Palestinians in the West Bank, and when we stop the genocide in the Gaza Strip, then we can go and talk about what the political solution, because I'm not a politician. I don't claim to know a lot about which solution and which
you create problems body. For politicians.
Well, that's our job, to critique what our leaders are doing.
Yes. And I want to make, I know you're a queer activist, and you have a perspective on militarism and something really quite evident. Any people watching the videos released by soldiers of the Israeli army, their conduct and their attitude, I know that you've addressed this issue of, here we call it a macho culture, but male show, whatever the word is, but that's obviously almost a sickness is what we're seeing here. And what have you been saying about that matter?
I think that in my refusal, it's important for me to draw the connection between the militarism in our society, the patriarchy, the gender standards, to my resistance to the mechanisms that oppress both the Palestinians and also the queer community and women. I think it's really important to notice that intersectionality of the different oppressions and the different struggles. And I think that if we're fighting for freedom and equality for my community, the queer community, then we should also fight for freedom and equality for other people who are facing oppression in the same land.
There's a term. Then there's a lot of really also not very actually persuasive propaganda comes from the Israeli spokespersons. I know that there's a term called pinkwashing.
Yes.
Where they say, oh, we're very liberated, we're very Western, we're kind of like Paris or New York or something. So is that true? And what is pinkwashing?
So pinkwashing is a term that talks about this facade that specifically now we're talking about the Israeli state, that it has of this human rights, even this place of gay liberation inside the Middle East, and it is one of Israel's tools to cover up the violation of human rights that is done against the Palestinians. And the pinkwashing it spreads to many different fields. It washes, it creates this facade when only parts of the queer community has these rights that Israel is talking about. Even if we look at trans rights that aren't equal to other parts of the queer community's rights, and of course washing the extreme violations of the Palestinians' human rights. That's what this term is talking about.
Yeah, I notice. Of course, politics is often reduced to just insults, but I know that a common way of arguing against people who are resisting the war is to say, well, if you had the Palestinians here, you would not be free. You know, they would oppress you. How can you say this? They don't like you. And you must hear that a lot.
Yes, it is something that we hear a lot.
By the way, you know Palestinians as well. I wonder sometimes when they say these things, which Palestinian they're referring to, or any Arab, I would say.
Yeah, I think that it's like every society, as the Israeli society is a complicated society with more conservative parts and more progressive parts, so is the Palestinian society. And I think it's important to fight this this flattening and of like this narrative that sees all the Palestinian people as one and not as a complicated society. And further than that, I'd like to say that this doesn't, that I feel like this argument tries to distract us from the actual topic and the of what we're trying to pursue. I think that everyone deserves human rights. And as I live in relative safety and freedom in Tel Aviv. I think that everyone in between the river and the sea should have the same rights of living with human rights and with freedom. And I think this I think this argument that people bring up is to distract from what we're actually trying to talk about.
Yeah. By the way, for listeners, we're speaking to two Israeli conscientious objectors, oftentimes referred to as refuseniks. I like that term. And on that question of the identity of your movement and your outlook, there's an organization, and it's got a people can find it on Twitter. It's at, and one of you have to tell me how to pronounce it. I think it's
Meservot. Yes, Meservot means refusers.
And both of you have association with it.
Yes, of course. Meservot is our political home. It's the network that supports us, that supported us throughout our refusal, and now we have the privilege to support the new refusers. Meservot means refusers in Hebrew, in the feminine conjugation, and it's the home for the Israeli refusers.
Could you talk about it as well? It's a new name to me. It seems to be internationally linked to war resistors, is it?
It is. We have links with a lot of organizations and a lot of conscientious objectors throughout the world. Since there has been the state and since there's been mandatory military service, there's been refusal to that. And if it was throughout the First Intifada, throughout the occupation
Lebanon
of
wars.
Lebanon War, the occupation of the 67 territories, the Second Intifada, there's been always constant refusal. And since 2016, there's this organization called Meservot, which not only aids conscientious objectors legally with the process of objecting, which is so important. To know that you have that back of a lawyer, of someone that knows what they're doing. It also brings a social home for the objectors. Mm. I know that in high school, I had friends that I wouldn't necessarily say that support my move of refusing, but since meeting my friends at Meservot, it has given me a home for my opinions, a home for my actions, and somewhere that I can feel safe, like talking about what I think and ideas, and really to create that home for activists.
Meservot.
Meservot.
I'm getting there. It's by the way, please go to it. It's a place to find out what's going on. I checked it out today. I'm so glad I learned about it. And it's at Meservot. Meservot.
Yes, we're Meservot. Yes, we're on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram, on TikTok.
And by the way, you also, I'm happy to see you supported and sponsoring your trip, our Labor for Palestine, the World Without War, and the Faculty for Palestine, and the Jewish Faculty Network, and an organization I much admire, we call it UJPO, United Jewish People's Order, and here and actually on this campus, QP Local 1281, you've been making the rounds. You're very busy, by the way. What kind of reception are you getting? What is the mood of the meetings that you speak to? I guess I'll ask you, Tal, first.
Well, this tour was sponsored by Independent Jewish Voices as well. We've been going
the
around.
One I left out.
the most important.
The chapters from east to west. And it's really been incredible seeing how much support we have throughout the Jewish community and also the non-Jewish community. It can feel very ostracizing being in Israel, always being with the same friends, and it's uncomfortable to deal with new people because you don't know what their opinions will be, how they will react when they hear that you refused. And here, it's been so incredible to meet so many new people, and they're very welcoming and interested in our stories.
Yeah. And you're both versed now in the issue, subject of nonviolence. There were two references. They would say, we all read Gandhi, or we read Martin Luther King. Do you study this issue? Because obviously you're in and out of confrontational circumstances. If you could talk to that.
I think, and I'd like to mention that in Misalvot Network, we have people from different kinds of ideologies. We have communists, we have pacifists, we have anarchists, ones who don't define their politics exactly. I do see myself as a pacifist. And actually, my first encounter with nonviolence theory and pacifism was with the writings of Jane Addams, that she was one of the creators of the profession of social work, and she fought against the American involvement in World War I, and she brought this very important pacifist and like feminist voice to the discourse that wasn't as strong as before, and that's where I encountered it first, and from there, I think it's a lifelong journey to learn more about the nonviolent theory and resistance.
Yeah. I'm struck by this. This history gives everybody challenges like this. I grew up in the Vietnam War period, and I used to have to face people who had been wounded, who would give me a hard time, and it becomes an art how to reach their mind when they are, you know, feverish, one might say. And I guess, we'd like to know, what are you hearing? Are you keeping track of news from Israel and from the region? And anything striking now with this, apropos of your work, Tal?
Well, we have to keep track. And a day ago, 2 days ago, the educational bookshop was again raided by the Israeli military. This time, with no government order. Masafer Yatta, the villages in the South Hebron Hills, have been on constant raids since the winning of the Oscars and also before. We hear about, as I said, tens of thousands, 40,000 refugees in the Jenin camp from Jenin, and we're hearing about expulsions of professors inside Israeli society, Jewish professors who speak out against the war and the genocide. Mm-hmm. It's depressing to see the stories coming out of our country. And that's what we're here to do, to kind of tell the world. And this is our call for help, our call for Canada, our call for the whole Western world to stop selling Israel weapons, to divest from Israeli-made goods, and to stop taking part in the genocide.
Mm-hmm. I assume you second that sentiment. Are there other elements to it that, I want to ask this question. Did you get a boost? Did it help that the International Court of Justice put Israel on the spot and other countries brought the, did that kind of shake people's thinking towards yourselves and toward the peace movement and also to reexamine things? Was that helpful?
I think it was helpful and it was important to declare, to have these statements from the International Court of Justice. Unfortunately, there isn't enough support of it, I feel like, and back home in Israel, it's seen as legal terror. That's the term that they use. And I really hope that it's another tool that can help us in the struggle. But I want to take the chance to say that that it's like the change is going to come from resisting within and without. And we're doing the resistance. We're part of the resistance within, and we need the international community and any Canadians that are listening to us now to do the resistance from without. And I'd like to support what Tal said, pressuring your government to be more active on stopping the genocide and stop selling arms to Israel is very critical, and to hold it and to hold the leaders of the genocide accountable for their crimes.
Mm. I really hope this continues in the war resisters effort, and we have a lot of activity here. Do people come to Israel who have the war resisters point of view, or do they speak there or participate in things? Are they allowed in the country, that kind of thing?
There are people that come to Israel with this opinion. It's mostly to be active, to put their bodies on the line, and to endanger themselves in, there's no other way to put it, but an active war zone, for example, in the West Bank with protective presence at Palestinian villages. There are a lot of deportations of international activists because of their activism. Usually the people with the most privilege in the West Bank, first of all, are Israelis with Israeli citizenship.
Yes.
Number two are Jewish people, international Jews. And number three are the Palestinians that actually live in those places.
Mm.
So it's very important also to the Palestinian communities that there is presence there and activism.
Well, I sure hope it continues to grow because the situation is dangerous. We're very, very grateful. We've had two visitors of the Israeli conscientious objectors, Einat Gerlitz and Tal Mitnick. I know you're having an effect. I'm getting calls from various people, and I hope you'll come back. And I notice more and more names, and again, we really want to build this organization, Mezavot.
Yes.
Perfect.
Mezavot. Okay, I'll keep working on it. You're wonderful people. They're a great inspiration, and we're very glad we could have you on the Taylor Report. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having us.